Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, the ATP Finals is over. Catherine Whittaker is free of fake hair and fake eyelashes and wearing normal clothes. Catherine, how are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, I'm all right. That's a very polite way of saying I look rough again.
No, natural. Normal. Back at home. No longer in front of a TV camera presenting for Amazon Prime Video. But it was a brilliant week. And, we're now back talking about tennis of the future and specifically looking ahead to the Australian Open. No Matt at the moment. However, we are joined by a special guest. We've got John Millman with us. Hello, John.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's good to tune in from down under here in Australia.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's more important than ever, really, to speak to you. And we spoke to you earlier in the year, but you are, I don't know how to say this, but you're kind of our guinea pig for what happens when somebody goes to Australia, because you are not at home. Where are you right now?
No, so my last tournament was in Sofia in Bulgaria, and I did the journey home to Australia. I couldn't get a flight into Brisbane, which is where I'm from, so I am currently in Sydney doing my 14-day government-mandated hotel quarantine. So it was quite an experience. You got picked up from the airport by the army, actually, and you got carted off in buses. Four different buses went to four different locations, and my location ended up at the Sofitel here in the Sydney CBD. So day 10 of 14, it hasn't been a pleasant experience, and one that's probably not conducive to playing tennis straight away after, I would say. So I know that Tennis Australia and the Australian Open team have got a lot on their plate with the current conditions.
Mm. You say it's not been a great experience. I mean, how are you feeling at the moment, and how have you felt day to day?
Yeah, I'm feeling like I wouldn't be able to play tennis. But it's solitary confinement as far as hotel stays go. We're used to it a little bit. At the US Open, you'd fly in and we had to do one day in the hotel, and that was in your hotel room while you're waiting for your test results. And that kind of became the norm for the last 4 months at all the tournaments we played at. But here it's a solid 14-day stint. We have testing on day 2 and day 10. So I had my second lot of testing today. And you're confined to the room. There's no windows that open. And you've just got to make do. So it's been a long trip. You struggle to fill in the days. And like anything, when you're locked away, you start to feel pretty lethargic, and you're starting to tear your hair out. I'm a fidgety person at the best of times. You know, I can't say sit still, but I've got no choice right now.
Presumably, John, you weren't expecting a pleasant experience. Has it been worse, different to what you expected?
Look, I'd probably say it's slightly worse, I think. I think my excitement factor of getting home to Australia probably outdid exactly what I was going to be facing. It's always, after you've gone away for quite a long trip, you always get so excited to return home. You know, that last tournament, normally it's in Bercy for me, but this time it was in Sofia, and that last tournament's... You're excited to get back home. And this trip especially, look, I've been on longer trips before, but this trip especially has felt extremely long due to the fact that this biosecurity bubble / tennis court quarantine process that we've been doing for the last kind of 4 months has made the trip really mentally draining. Mentally, it's felt like a really long one. So I was super excited to get back home, get on that plane. Unfortunately, you're welcome to this 14-day hotel quarantine, but not long to go now.
Did you ever consider not making the trip? Because some of your compatriots haven't.
100%. Look, that was something that I'd planned potentially to do. I was, my girlfriend's from Germany, so I was going to spend a little bit of time there, but also maybe get over to Alicante and do some training with Alex Dimonor, that's where he's based out of. But that was when the original plan was that the Australian Open was going to, the bubble was going to open on about the December the 6th, December the 7th. That was what was originally touted. And that would actually work in well with my European visa. You know, I'm only allowed 90 days out of every 180. But when the bubble started getting pushed back, my days started running out with my visa. And second of all, it started to mean that I was going to be spending almost all of the month of December not being able to get back to Brisbane. Then I heard that it was all going to be moved to one state potentially. And I just thought going into the Australian Open, I really needed to get back to Brisbane, back home, just rejuvenate a little bit with your friends and family. That can really help your mental psyche just a little bit. So, and is often underestimated. So when that bubble started to get pushed back and when it looked like there was going to be no events up in Brisbane and I wouldn't be able to go back home, I thought it would be best to get on a flight and unfortunately stick out this 14-day hotel quarantine.
And you mentioned that it's difficult to fill the days. What has a typical day been like over the last 10?
Well, I wake up hopefully, and I've been doing that, which is good. But I have got an exercise bike, and I've got a couple of weight plates here, kind of in the room, jammed in the room. And I'm no Tour de France rider. There's only so much I can do on the exercise bike, and I have been, you know, just watching movies while I do a session on the bike, or trying to do a little bit of a gym process. So that fills in a few hours of the day. Then there's some crosswords that I'm doing. I'm playing cards because my partner, my missus, is here with me. So we're playing some cards and a bit of television watching, but really there's not a whole lot. I wish I could be a bit more productive, but yeah, I'd be lying if I was saying that I was being a whole lot more productive.
Yeah, because I mean, you said we've seen the videos that you've posted and the pictures you've posted on Instagram, which gives it a kind of an idea, a little diary of what life is like for you there. And I saw there was a band downstairs, wasn't there? And people were on the balconies, but you don't have a balcony.
We don't have the balcony, no. And look, the Sofitel here in Sydney have been doing as good a job as they can to make do of a pretty tough situation. Like you touched on yesterday, they had the band there from 6 till 8, which was awesome. Just a little bit of live music. We had some wine tasting today, which was really interesting via Zoom. So I think these conditions have, have created the need for people to be a bit more creative as to how we can get through these tough times. And look, the Sofitel Sydney, they have really tried to do as best as they can. It's a pretty tough circumstance, though. It's a tough situation, and one that I'm not really wanting to do again. If I can plan around not doing this again, perhaps I won't be coming back for Christmas next time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're certainly hoping that vaccines, et cetera, kick in, and obviously things have worked very well in terms of dampening down the virus in Melbourne, although it's been obviously a really tough period, hasn't it, over the last 3 or 4 months in Australia. So hopefully you won't have to. But I mean, the trip itself that you took, you had some great success, didn't you? I mean, you won your first title. Does that feel now worth it?
And that's the big question, because prior to going away on this trip, there was a lot of apprehension in the decision-making process, especially here in Australia, where we've taken such a stern measures on COVID-19 and how we dealt with it, and what we've seen in the media too of you know, there's been a 20 cases in South Australia and they shut down the state. So prior to going away, you know, I had it in my head that it was a really dangerous prospect, and I was really unsure as to whether I wanted to take on that risk. But in the end of the day, I needed to make some money and I needed to get back to work. And I really wanted to get back out there and competing, because I genuinely do really enjoy it. So I did decide to do the trip. And it was challenging, like I touched on. It was mentally draining, not being able to get outside of a bubble that consisted of just courts and the hotel. That's one of the beauties of being able to play tennis and do what we do, is to be able to experience the different cultures. And don't forget about that little mental release that you get when you leave your hotel and go down the road for a walk and a coffee and grab a bite to eat at the local cafe, wherever you are in the world. You couldn't do that this time. So it was draining. But in the end, I was really glad with the decision. And I think all the players and the tournaments and all the organizers should give themselves a real big pat on the back for really getting out there, playing tennis and making an effort to return to the game and get a product out there again. It was, I thought the players did a really good job after early on, you know, when COVID had hit. Maybe a couple of players had made some of the best decisions. I got to say, once the tournament started, I thought the players really, you know, were really responsible and kept it all about the tennis. And I thought that was awesome. And we got a product back out there. And I think that's really important looking back and reflecting on that. But for me personally, it was a good trip. I obviously got to win my first title in Kazakhstan, which I want to say was an unbelievably run tournament. All credit to them. I would say, I'm not just saying that because I won the event, but I think anyone who went there had similar sentiments. It was an incredible job, considering it was a pop-up tournament. They had about 6 weeks' notice. It was incredible. And obviously, it's going to be very special for me. I'm going to remember it fondly for being my first ATP Tour title and just a really special experience during a pretty tough year. It was nice to have a bit of a shining light there.
Was it a coincidence, John, the timing of that first tour title, or was the price you had to pay for being there and competing, was that a factor? I mean, you don't seem like someone that ever struggles for motivation, but was it an extra, you know, fire in your belly?
Yeah, look, it was. I felt as if it was a long time coming to potentially win one of these. I've been in a couple of finals before, and where my ranking's been at consistently, I feel like I've been consistently putting myself in positions to be exposed at this level and to have the potential chance to win one of these things. But I think it's quite kind of fitting when you see my career a little bit, and it hasn't always been smooth sailing. There's been ups and downs, especially with injuries and kind of the way I play can sometimes, you know, I try to bring a certain level of physicality, and sometimes it might not look too easy for me out there. It's kind of fitting that I managed to have that breakthrough in such a difficult year that's been difficult for everybody. So I look back at that quite fondly, and it's funny that one of my greatest personal achievements on the court has come in one of the more memorable years. It's a nice feeling that I managed to mentally tough it out and get through it, because look, it's always challenging, I think, and I cop a little bit of criticism for saying this, but it's always challenging as an Australian. I know that we have a wealthy federation. I get reminded of that constantly. But to be a professional tennis player from Australia, you don't get to spend much time at home. When you lose a tournament, you're staying at that tournament and you're trying to work hard to get ready for the next one. You can't just duck off like you might be able to if you're, say, from Europe and you're doing the European indoor swing. So I do think that it can be sometimes a little more challenging when you're so far away from home. And it's just nice to get your just rewards. I took on a bit of a risk to do such a long trip during this COVID time, and it was really nice to get the rewards with a title.
Has there been a moment in the last 10 days where you fleetingly thought, I would hand back my title for my freedom?
Not a chance. Look, if it means doing another 14 days, which would be so difficult to give back my title, no, I'd do a year in here. That was something that I really had identified over the last couple of years, really, that it was a box that I really wanted to tick to win one of these tour titles. They're not easy to win. For some people they are, but for the majority of us, they're quite challenging to win. And it's given me a lot of satisfaction and also confidence going into 2021, because I definitely feel as if once you get that breakthrough, perhaps I can get a couple more titles.
Given that, then, do you think you'd be finding this quarantine even harder if you'd bombed out first round in every tournament on the trip?
If the trip had been a disaster, this would be, you know, rubbing salt into the wounds, like we say here. It would you would feel like it wasn't quite worth it. But overall, the trip was really positive. It was a good experience, I think it was really satisfying just as a whole that we managed to get a product back out there. And it's not just the tennis players, but the tournaments and everyone whose work depends on tennis being out there. I think it's super important. And so when I reflect, that's nearly just as satisfying as winning the title. It's not quite, I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to be one of those people, but it is really satisfying that I was part of getting some type of product out there. Like every other tennis player, I'm not special by any means whatsoever. But I think that can sometimes be underrated when we look back at the year 2020 and what tennis was.
As things stand, John, reading this morning The Age and Sydney Morning Heralds here in the UK, it seems that plans are starting to become more concrete for the Australian Open. Finally, it looks like it's going to be a one or more likely a 2 week delay from what I'm reading, starting on February 1st with what's reported as a 2 week quarantine. At the moment, they're describing it as a 2 week quarantine like you're experiencing, where you have to get that out of the way before you can go practice or compete in any tournaments at all. What have you heard? And if that is the case, how are players going to get on?
Yeah, first of all, it's been challenging. I think Craig Tiley and the team there at Tennis Australia and the Australian Open do an incredible job year in, year out. And I think this has been so challenging for them because the goalposts have been moved so many times, I think, from the local health authorities there. But it does look like we're starting to see some momentum now. Some plans are starting to get in place as to how it's going to look. Originally, I was hearing the similar things to yourself, where players would have to come in and do a 14-day hard lockdown like I'm doing right now. And I've always been of the opinion if they had to do this and after living through it, there's zero chance that the tournament goes ahead, because I just don't think that, first of all, it's conducive to a player's health to come in, do 14 days confined to a room and then go out there and play a grand slam. I think that it's you're at risk of injury, but you lose so much conditioning. I mean, this is going to take me a week or two just to start feeling the ball again when I get out of here. So I've always thought that if that was the case, it wouldn't exist. The grand slam would not exist. But I am starting to hear that there has been some wiggle room lately. And it looks as if whilst there might not be any competition in quarantine, like we have done at the US Open, where we could, you know, there wasn't a mandated 14 day and we could compete once we flew in there. It does look like there's going to be some biosecurity bubble where we'll be able to go and train and then go back to our hotel room. So If this is the case, and this is what I'm hearing is more likely, if this is the case, I'm sure that it'll go ahead. I think it'll be pushed back. I think we'll see the start date pushed back a week or two, if I'm to be completely honest. And whether that means we're going to be able to have 1 week of an ATP event, maybe week one elsewhere, I'm unsure, and then go into Australia. If not, we might not be seeing any lead-in events. It might be 14 days where we can train. Unfortunately, I don't see the Australian government allowing competition during that 14 days, but I do think we will be able to play, and I think maybe we might go straight into the Australian Open. Again, it's speculation, and we've seen the goalposts move so many times on this issue, but that's my gut feel right now.
Hmm. What do you think the reaction of players will be to that? What sort of turnout would you expect?
I think if it is that, I think we'll still get a very good turnout. It's not ideal, but I do think players would be more receptive to the idea of the 14-day, but being able to train throughout it. What I think would help is if there's actually tournaments after the Australian Open, maybe perhaps in Australia or close by, because it is a tough trip to make where you come all the way to Australia only for one event, even it being a Grand Slam event. So I would like to see maybe a couple more tournaments added on. Unfortunately, I'm not sure what the implications are, because that would affect the tour, both the WTA and the ATP, in terms of the tournaments after the Australian Open. Normally, we're heading to New York Open, which I don't think is going ahead, but New York Open or Montpellier or the Golden Swing over in South America. So I'm unsure as to how that's going to look. But ideally, I think that would be a great situation. Then we could come and play and get our bang for buck, so to speak, when coming and playing in Australia. But I do think that it's still going to have a pretty good turnout. I think Grand Slams are something special. I think the players earmark them as something that's a priority, regardless of whether there are multiple tournaments in and around them. But it's not ideal. But what is during this pandemic time?
Yeah, very well put. Very well put. I mean, you're a good person to talk to because you're going through it. You're a player. I also think it's interesting to get your view because you've recently joined the ATP Player Council. So you're getting more of a feel, I would imagine, for what other players feel and the decision-making that is occurring. It's been an interesting time, hasn't it, the last couple of months? The PTPA has been developed. What is your view of that organisation, Professional Tennis Players Association, a union, effectively, that Vasek Pospisil and Novak Djokovic have spearheaded? What is your view of it?
Yeah, it's an interesting time, isn't it? And one that I think has still a bit to play. Right now, my understanding of the PTPA is that it's very much in its infant stages. Bylaws are still being written, but I do understand that they are being written right now. So I think we'll get more of an indication as to what the PTPA is and what it stands for after the bylaws get written, and whether there is maybe a little bit of crossover there with the ATP, which I've been told. Well, everyone's heard the press releases from the PTPA that there won't be, but until we see those bylaws, I'm not sure what will happen. But for myself personally, I didn't sign the PTPA. My reason being is that I do feel as if we can work with the tournaments and the players. I think it's a partnership there. I don't necessarily think that the players should have 100% of the say at the table, because I think without the tournaments, the players wouldn't exist, and vice versa. The tournaments won't exist without the players either. And my second notion would be Andre Gaudenzi. He's just got given the job in 2020. He's been faced with the Australian Open bushfires. He's then been faced with a global pandemic. And I feel as if we owe it as a group to allow him to get his vision across before we start to create some big divide, I guess, between the ATP and another union or players association. So I think it's within our best interest to really let him give him a bit of time to get that vision out there. And I don't think he's been given that just yet due to the crazy 2020 circumstances that's been thrown in our direction. But look, I think we'll know more about the PTPA, and that's what I was kind of waiting. I was waiting to see more and to understand it more before I put my name down to anything.
That's very interesting. Catherine, do you have anything else to add? I've got one more question for John, but if you have anything else before I pile in.
I'm quite interested in what's it actually like being on the Players' Council, the sort of the mechanics of it, especially at a time like this. Are you kind of being undated with queries? I don't know. Yeah, it's sort of day to day. What does it involve?
Yeah, look, it's been an interesting experience, and they've actually got some more re-elections coming up, as you know. So, and I've thrown my hat in the ring because I've found the experience interesting. I've always had a real interest of how tennis works, and also I'll talk the arm off the leg off a chair. You know, I will I can talk anything, and I really enjoy talking tennis. So, look, it's been an interesting experience. I think it's definitely opened my eyes a little more to the goings ons of the tournaments. I've always found it interesting because I've grown up playing in Brisbane, where the Brisbane International is, and during my preseason, the big rollout for this tournament comes and for the Brisbane International, and you start to really get a feel of just how much goes on behind the scenes before the players rock up and you start hitting tennis balls, which is sometimes a bit of a misconception, I think, that we as players have. Obviously, being an Australian on the council, I think some people probably think that I'm more privy to information because I'm ticking the Australian box and I'm ticking the player council box. And unfortunately, those people, you know, we're hearing information at the same time, but the goalposts have changed so much that information that we're getting can be taken with a grain of salt sometimes. But it's definitely been an eye-opening experience, and it's one that is quite fascinating. And right now, it's probably quite a tumultuous time to be taking a seat at the on the player council. But, you know, it creates a bit of excitement in your life.
And you've got some pretty big names on that council alongside you, haven't you? What is it like to, I don't know, have you spent any time with them virtually at all on Zoom calls or chats?
Yeah, look, the communication's actually pretty good within the player council. And we've had Zoom calls, we've had chats, you know, a bit like now. But it's cool, you know. Obviously, some of the players have, and some of the big boys, you know, Roger and Andy and Rafa, they really are passionate about the game, and they really do, you know, enjoy talking about tennis and talking about the governance and what we can be doing better. And I really feel as if their heart's in it, which is incredible considering, you know, just how much they've got going on in their lives, I can imagine. So, look, to begin with, I reckon I was probably a little bit quiet, especially in the first meeting. I didn't probably have too much to offer because you're still finding your feet and probably let the big boys talk just a little bit more. But they're very welcoming, and I genuinely do believe that the best interest, they're really after the best interests of the game, and that's where there's probably a bit of a sticking point when you hear in the media all the divide amongst necessarily the players, PTPA, ATP, etc. Trying not to speak out of turn there, but I really do feel as if that genuinely there's a real passion for the game, and we want to continually see the product of the ATP get better and better.
You could end up being the players' quarantine spokesman. Because not many at this stage have been through what you're going through.
Yeah, and look, I really hope that the players don't have to do this because it is a really challenging process, one that I'm not going to do again. I've decided I'm not doing it again. So if I had to, yeah, if the vaccine didn't get out there and there was this two-week hotel quarantine again, then unfortunately I'll be spending Christmas elsewhere. I don't have regrets doing it this time, but now that I've lived it and done it, I wouldn't be doing the hotel quarantine again. It's a brutal experience.
Well, that's a really interesting insight, John. I think it's an important one. You know, there's no point sugarcoating what this is like for people. And I've seen a few of people within tennis, not players as just alone, although I followed Daria Gavrilova's experience, but I've seen Darren Cahill go through it, and Barbara Schett recently has been going through it, and it's something that I think we can think about and not think is that big a deal until you actually have to go through it and be in that solitary confinement.
And Barbara, actually, I was very jealous of Barbara. She heralds, obviously, when she's back in Australia, she's actually from Queensland at the Sunshine Beach there with her husband Joshy Eagle, who grew up around there, and I was so jealous of Babs because she got to fly into Brisbane, so she got a hotel in Queensland. I'm pretty sure it's Queensland's the only state that let their people out for half an hour a day. So she was going to the rooftop, I'm pretty sure, where there's a rooftop pool there, and along with the other quarantined guests, they were allowed half an hour a day outside and getting a bit of fresh air, but that's not afforded here in New South Wales. They do things differently here. So I was super jealous when I saw her half hour of sunshine, because we have not had a lick of fresh air for 10 days now.
Wow.
You can't open your window. Did I hear you say that? Is that right?
There's no windows that open here. No. So it's, recycled air the whole time. And being someone that's from Australia, but Queensland especially, we're very much an outdoorsy folk. We spend all our childhood outside, and then to top it off, I've come from the indoor swing in Europe, where we've been confined to hotel and courts. We didn't get outside then, so I don't know what the sun is. I heard it's pretty hot in Queensland though, so it's going to take me a while. Just to realize what the yellow thing up is in the sky. It's been really challenging. I think that's been the toughest thing. If I'd had a little balcony or just the ability to open up the windows, I actually think that it'd shave off a few days mentally. But no, I'm doing the full. You know, if you're going to do something, do it properly. So I'm just really testing out my mental capabilities. For this full 14 days, you know, I wanted to do it tough.
Well, you sure have. what are you most looking forward to once this is over? I mean, you've got 4 days to go. Obviously, you've got to get out and go somewhere. Where are you going to go? And what have you been dreaming of that you can't do?
Well, that was an ordeal in itself, you know, actually being able to get out, because the Queensland and New South Wales border was still shut. It actually opened. I got news 2 days ago that it opened up it's going to open up on the 1st of December. But New South Wales was still considered a hotspot. Sydney was still considered a hotspot. They haven't had a positive case in 30 days, I think, but it was still considered a hotspot. So I had to go through the whole process of, first of all, trying to get an exemption to get out half an hour early out of the quarantine, because the only flight I could get is at 5:05. There's no other later flight that's flying to Queensland on the 30th. And my time slot to go out was at 4 o'clock, in between 4 and 6. So first of all, I had to get a half hour exemption. So I had to apply for New South Wales Health for that online, filling out all these documents, sending in documents. So I did get approval of that after my second attempt, which was really nice. And then I had to get approval from the Queensland health to, so I didn't have to re-quarantine, because that was something that could potentially happen, because the borders are closed. I'd do the 2 weeks here and then I'd have to do another 2 weeks in Queensland because the borders had been shut, which is not something I wanted to do at all. But I did get exemptions there again on the second attempt there. So that was ordeal in itself. But when I do get home now, one of the things I really miss when I travel is Australia's cafe culture. I love going out for breakfast. It's an institution. You know, we have lots of cafes that that do, you know, breakfast is a religion in Australia. And getting myself a flat white with, you know, a bit of avocado on sourdough with some poached eggs and halloumi on the side is something that I can taste already.
What a lovely thought. That'll sustain you, and you've only got a few days to go. Final thing, John, because of the year we've had, we invented a series of shows called Tennis Relived, where we were looking back on great moments from the slams, and we did daily shows during what would have been Roland Garros and Wimbledon back in May and June. And we're going to do some of them ahead of the Australian Open, I think, particularly now that we're likely to have a delay of a week or two. If you were to pick a moment from the Australian Open that you've seen from your childhood, from your growing up, from being a tennis player, whatever you've seen, what memory would you want to relive and hear about?
Yeah, it's a really tough one, isn't it? Because there's been so many good memories, but one that sticks out in my mind, and it'll sound a little stupid, but it has significance to myself, because we've seen some epic matches. We've seen some epic five-set matches in I'm speaking on the men's side, obviously. In the women, we've seen some great ones too, but we've seen some epic five-set grueling matches at the Australian Open. But one of the first times I was at the Australian Open and that I got to see live was actually when Roger Federer went and won it would have been in 2007 was the year I'd just finished school. And he played Andy Roddick in the semifinals. And, you know, I'd watched Roger on TV and he was at the top of his game. But Andy Roddick had won Kooyong, the lead in there. I think he beat Roger on the way. And I remember Andy saying something along the lines of, you know, he just felt pretty confident in his game and he thought he was closing that gap a little bit. I think he might have even beat Roger in the World Tour Finals the year before at the end of the year, and he was closing that gap a little bit. Now, I managed to score tickets. It was the first time I'd been inside Rod Laver Arena watching a match. And, you know, I was just up in the bleachers and I managed to score tickets to watch this match between Roger Federer and Andy Roddick, and that gap was apparently closing. And I think it's pretty special when you get to see one of the greatest ever playing at the top of his game. And I thought the way he dismantled Andy Roddick that day was witnessing an absolute genius at the top of his game. And that one sticks to mind. I know it wasn't an epic match by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's really special to be able to watch some of the world's best play at their absolute best. And I've managed to see it with Roger. I actually was managing to call a match on radio when Novak Djokovic went and dismantled David Ferrer. I was courtside calling it on radio. It was at the Australian Open, and it was insane to watch him play. And you could tell he was feeling it. And when you see these best guys play their best tennis, I find that pretty special. So I was lucky enough to be there for that one, and that's what I'm going to choose. I know it sounds you know, it's pretty basic, it's not one of the epics, but it was pretty special to watch, to be there live, my first match at Rod Laver Arena, watching it and watching one of the greats play some of his great tennis was something I'll always remember.
There are no wrong suggestions, John. David basically only picks Pete Sampras matches from the 90s. So.
Correct.
I wasn't old enough to go and watch Pete Sampras live at the Australian Open, you know. I wasn't from Melbourne, so I couldn't. I was from Queensland and I didn't get to see him live, but I would have loved to have watched some of Sampras. And that era I loved, you know. I loved Agassi and I loved Sampras and, yeah, others special.
Tune into Tennis Relived and David will recreate the experience for you of being in the 90s.
I will. I'm a tennis fan. I'm a fan of tennis. So I will. I'll go back and listen to them.
Well, we will certainly be reliving, I think, that Roger Federer-Andy Roddick match in some way or another. I mean, I always remember Roddick was coached by Jimmy Connors at the time, and the first question to Andy Roddick in the press conference afterwards was, what did Jimmy say to you about that? And Andy, just looking chastened, said, he just gave me a beer.
And it was one of those, you can understand that reaction, you know, from the coach's box, because it was a dismantling, but it was pure genius from Roger, and it was him at the top of his game. And maybe he gets that moment a little bit more, but every now and again, you know, once or twice a year, you walk on the court and everything feels unbelievable. You know, it doesn't matter what you do, it just comes out the middle. Your timing's incredible, and you just know you're having one of those days. And probably Roger and some of our greats, Rafa and Novak, they probably experience that a little bit more often. But I can tell you, as a tennis player, it's one of the greatest things. And it just looked like he was having one of those days where, you know, from nearly the first point, after he kind of felt that one out, you could tell that he was having one of those days, and we're about to witness some pretty special tennis.
We sure did. Well, John, I very much hope the next 4 days go as painlessly as possible for you and your girlfriend, and you're out and you can enjoy your magnificent breakfast, and that ball comes out of your racket, out of the middle, when it matters most over the Australian summer. It's really been lovely to have you on. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Well, Catherine, that was really quite something, wasn't it, to hear from John and to hear, I don't know why, but I didn't expect it to be quite as jarring to listen to as that, just how difficult this period of time has been. I mean, I'm sure it would be difficult for me, but for some reason, because it was John Milburn, Mr. Positive, and I know I'm a fine one to talk, but he never seems to have a bad day, does he? And he's a human being. It brings it home to me a bit more, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't expecting him to put a spin on anything. You know, he's a straight as an arrow, salt of the earth kind of guy. I just expected him to be focusing on the positives, as sports people do. And I suppose in some regards he was doing that. You know, he's got no regrets about the trip or anything. He's obviously completely delighted with that title in in Astana, which I want to shout, even though it wasn't Astana that had the exclamation marks, but it's a bit like Ostrava and it happened at the same time. So I want to say Astana. But anyway, yeah, so it took me aback a little bit how Frankie was about the whole experience. And let's remember, he's not alone in that hotel room. He's got his girlfriend with him. I cannot imagine that experience alone. It knocked the wind out of me a bit, actually, hearing that he didn't have a window that would open. I know Darren Cahill on Twitter mentioned that he was in that situation in his lockdown, but I just assumed that a tennis player with their with their power and resources somehow would be able to make sure they had fresh air, if not a balcony. So that really knocked me for six a bit, actually, imagining that. And it made me think about something Tim Henman was saying throughout last week, which is a very sort of boring tennis player-y thing to say in interviews, which is process, not outcome. That's what they are. That's the outlook they're trained to have on their life and their career. Don't think about the outcome and what's at the end of the process. Just focus on the now and the process. Well, that kind of stitches you right up in a quarantine scenario, doesn't it? Where all you want to be doing is focusing on the freedom and the outcome at the end and not on the absolutely, what are even the words for it? The mind-numbing depression and anxiety inducing process. So maybe actually sports people, even though they're good at focusing on the positives and all those cliches, maybe they aren't actually best placed to cope with anything like that. But I'm not sure who would be, frankly. Who would be well placed to cope with that?
Certainly concentrates minds in the short term, though, as regards to the Australian Open, and let's hope that the Tennis Australia team are able to get the answers they want, because that sounds like it is not a going concern if they can't. And, you know, John Millman was very, very clear in regard to the fact that 2 weeks of that, what he's had without any chance to get out and practice, is just not going to work.
Can either of you see Roger Federer doing that? Rafael Nadal doing that? No. I mean, I sort of would like to see it. Pop some cameras in, create a Big Brother style situation.
You might notice Catherine saying either of you. That's because Matt Roberts has joined us. Hello, Matt.
Hello. I've replaced John Millman. Do I need to start my sentences with "look, mate"?
You are actually occupying the place on my screen where John Millman recently was.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, your room looks much nicer, I've got to say, Matt.
Yeah, the air looks fresher.
I think once we've done this podcast, I will be allowed out of it. So another difference.
What did you think of all that?
Well, it made me even more pleased than I was that he'd got that title, because I felt pleased for him at the time. But knowing now that it really did make that trip worthwhile and is kind of sustaining him a little bit through this 14-day period is something. And it also made me think about what we talk about in tennis generally in terms of where you come from having quite a big impact on your career. And, you know, that commitment he made to go over and do these 3 or 4 months of tennis, you know, that was a big commitment anyway, given the travel in this weird time. When you then consider what he was saying about not having any kind of hub in Europe, not being able to pop home like some players could, literally going from hotel to hotel, and then having this price to pay afterwards of these 14 days quarantining and all the stresses of the borders potentially closing between states and all the sort of admin and paperwork involved in that just sort of added to my sense that, you know, some players have experienced this harder than others, I suppose, and it's been difficult for everyone, but, you know, not everyone is on an equal footing even in these times. And some very interesting things. I had the same impression you had about maybe I was expecting him to gloss over how hard it was, but, you know, he used the word brutal and he wouldn't wish it on anyone and all those kind of phrases. It's clearly clearly been very difficult. And then just that insight on how Australia is treating the virus so differently to what we're experiencing, I found fascinating just and refreshing, actually. You know, a hot spot, even though there's been no cases for 30 days, stuff like that is kind of extraordinary to hear. You know, they've been one of the countries that have led the way, really. And they're not going to let tennis disrupt that, and nor should they.
And we've had the news today in New Zealand, which has had a very similar policy to Australia in terms of locking down and quarantining and preventing international travel. They did issue sparsely some sports waivers, in particular for the Pakistan cricket team to come and tour the country for an international series. That was something actually that we talked about a little on the ATP Finals coverage last week, because Michael Venus, the New Zealand doubles player, was very outspoken about that, because he didn't think it was fair that some sports were receiving waivers for players and others weren't. And he was in a whirlwind of uncertainty last week, and by playing the O2, he was potentially jeopardising his ability to get home for Christmas. But those waivers were issued, not to Michael Venus, but to the Pakistan cricket team. And now six members of the playing team, I believe, so far have tested positive. And if you put that into context of, you know, John Millman telling us that Sydney is considered a hotspot, etc., that is a really, really big deal. And I don't think the Australian or the Victorian government probably needed anything to harden their stance or to make them feel more assured in their stance. But that sort of news and that development is certainly going to make them, I think, less inclined to soften their stance as Tennis Australia clearly want them to.
Yeah, we will follow the story and bring updates to you in each of our shows. We've got lots more podcasts planned over the next few weeks, and whenever we have news, we'll bring it to you. And if there's something of great significance, then we'll do an extra show as well, because not like I need an excuse, is it? We did have one other bit of news yesterday with Madrid announcing itself as a two-week tournament, which, in all honesty, when we drilled down into the detail, seemed to actually add one day onto the men's main draw event and I think 3 days onto the women's main draw event to become a 10-day event. So it didn't really feel as though it was that enormous an announcement to me. But still, that's what they've said that they're planning to do. And we're kind of waiting, aren't we, to see what the knock-on effects are going to be. More generally, John Wertheim was reporting yesterday that he had heard, and I don't know how firm this was, but he'd heard that Indian Wells, for instance, wants a guarantee of being allowed to have 25% fans in the stadium in order to run that tournament. So there's a lot of unknown. And
who would that guarantee be from? The governor of California?
Yes, right. Exactly. And if we consider, first of all, that the governor of California, I mean, they basically told them to cancel the event after one case, didn't they?
It's not Arnold Schwarzenegger anymore, is that correct?
No, I think that's correct, yeah.
It's not the Terminator in charge
of
whether or not Indian Wells happens, okay.
No. But, I mean, if you consider that the next tournaments that we're going to have are going to be those Australian Open prelims, if they happen, I mean, and that's not even known. There's just a lot of uncertainty right now, and the tours are going to have to be flexible to make this work. I'm sure they will. I mean, there's a lot of good people who work in this, but there's still a lot of uncertainty ahead.
It does. These decisions, though, these announcements, do make you wonder how much power the tours have, because, you know, it does feel increasingly like it's a land grab, doesn't it? That land grabs are possible. I know the French Open kind of opened the floodgates for this, but, you know, that announcement from Madrid yesterday wasn't made in conjunction with the ATP.
Well, it did have Steve Simon quotes in it.
Right.
It did have Steve Simon quotes in it. So, but how much the hand has been forced there, I don't know. I mean, his quotes were in there lauding it as this great thing. But like I say, when you actually look at the detail, it didn't seem that much different to me to what it already is.
Although, weren't you saying, David, that that is kind of part of Gaudenzi's plan in terms of wanting to extend the 1,000 events, combine them and make them slightly longer events?
Yeah, when you read his sort of plan to kind of, he wants to pool digital rights, pool media TV rights and be able to sell them in a much more joined up fashion and including the strength of the women's circuit and have more combined events or at least make more of the combined events and lengthen them. So it definitely fits in with his strategy more generally. But I think that strategy was drawn up initially pre-pandemic. I think in many ways his stance seems to have hardened since then because of realizing, and that's why we ended up with all the talk of maybe we should merge, you know, and all that sort of thing. Now, he hasn't said that. But he certainly moved those two tours in his thinking. It seems a lot closer together.
It does feel a little bit like you can just announce yourself as something and the world has to accept it. We are the PTPA. We are now a two-week event. We are now in October. I am Taylor Swift, folks. Deal with it.
She's got the jumper.
I'm an Olympic gold medal winner.
She bought the cardigan yesterday. Was it the folklore cardigan?
I actually bought the cardigan 2 months ago, David, and I've waited for it on back order due to high demand.
Right.
It was well worth the wait.
And I mean, especially given that it worked for Roland Garros.
Exactly.
If
they hadn't made that incredibly selfish decision, they probably wouldn't have happened.
It kind of becomes a philosophical discussion. Do the ends justify the means? I actually think it's a lot healthier if the slams are in conversations with the tours and it's an open discussion and they're all trying to work out what's best for everyone. But the French Open would point to the fact that it happened this year safely, to the fact that it was the right decision to be made. So it did kind of set a precedent there for other events with the power to follow, I suppose.
Just decide what you want to be, both of you, and make an announcement, and it is so.
I want to be a tennis podcaster. How about that? When you look at the way the PTPA happened, it feels like there's a bit of that in there, really. We're going to set this thing up, whether you like it or not, and we reckon that will make it happen eventually. And very interesting to hear John Millman on it. Clearly not 100% convinced. I'm waiting to see, and I think there are a lot of players in that sort of position. One of which is Andy Murray, of course, who is one of John Millman's fellow player council members. And he said the same, didn't he? He said, I'm not going to sign the PTPA. I'm not going to go in that photo. I don't think it's without merit entirely. I think there are good points that are being made about it, but I want to give this regime a chance, meaning Andrea Gaudenzi, Massimo Calvelli, who are at the top of the ATP, and see what happens with them. I mean, I know Andy Roddick, for instance, who was a big sort of trailblazer in terms of pushing the last one of these attempts to get more player power 10 or so years ago, felt that this is just the wrong time for something like this. You know, this is, he felt it was just sort of tone deaf is what he was saying on Tennis Channel. But Andy Murray gave a big interview to some of the British media a couple of days ago and was speaking about various things, including the fact that he personally hopes that if vaccines are developed, that all players take them and seem to feel that they should be a requirement in what he said.
Is that ethical? I mean, I know we're at the end of a podcast here, and that's an extraordinarily broad question to be asking. But when there is going to be a queue and supply is going to be limited and the most vulnerable are rightly going to be at the front of the queue. Will it be ethical for sports people to jump the queue? I certainly think a case can be made. I'm playing devil's advocate to an extent, but
my feeling would be about timings, really, when you bring in a rule like that. If you feel that, is there a sort of line in the sand that you say, right, from now on, you only play if you've got a vaccine, and maybe that line has to be drawn once it's sufficiently available.
If you're vaccinating 60,000 people a day, which is an ambitious target, I believe that's what's being targeted by a lot of advanced countries, then you're still looking at a year to vaccinate the vulnerable, the people on the considered vulnerable.
Hmm. So we'll see.
That's another podcast, isn't it?
I certainly take the point
moral
about
philosophy,
about whether it's ethical. He also talked about, he backed the idea of having independent investigations for tours, for allegations such as those made against Alexander Zverev recently. And actually, he said that he feels that the tour could be more assertive in situations like that and actually act quicker and react quicker. Felt that they took too long in doing so, which is something we've discussed. And he talks about his own physical fitness, Andy Murray. And the quotes of Mats Wilander from back at the US Open were put to him, and kind of asked almost whether he has those up on his wall as motivation. And he said, you know, on a very short-term basis, that sort of thing works. But actually, it was a moment that I saw, I think, his body fat index that he saw and he wasn't happy with. And he decided
that's... Don't show him mine.
That's got to change, he said. So, and then back at it just makes me remember this time last year at the Davis Cup where Catherine made a suggestion about how he might lose some. But anyway, he still sounds as ambitious and motivated as ever, doesn't he?
He said that he's hitting. He said he's hitting certain fitness targets at a higher peak than he ever has done previously. Now he seems very aware of certain limitations, but I think that is making him more determined to maximise in the areas that he's not limited.
Yeah. I think speed was an area where he thought he was never going to reach the levels he's reached before, but he was almost talking about it in terms of he can make that up in other areas.
I found that very interesting because one of the things Tim Hemmard said in your Prime video coverage, Catherine, last week was he questions how useful strength is in terms of muscle mass and that sort of thing, in terms of limiting your movement. And Murray does seem to, well, he stresses strength as one of the things, one of the indicators that he's been able to improve. So... I don't know.
I think
it just
really depends on your body type, doesn't it? I mean, not having any muscles is really working for Daniil Medvedev.
But... Acute lack of bicep.
Acute lack of bicep. But, you know, if Stan Wawrinka said, I'm going to slim down and to take the pressure off my knees or whatever, he would be a shell of the player, wouldn't he? I think it's different folks, different strokes.
I remember both Mark Philippoussis and specifically Richard Krajicek doing exactly that, losing quite a lot of weight to try to extend their careers take the pressure off their
knees. Murray has already tried that, hasn't he? He did go through a phase where he lost a lot of weight, a lot of muscle mass from his upper body, I believe, to take the pressure off his hips and other joints. And so I can only assume that, you know, he's paying a whole team of the most qualified possible people to assess and optimize his prospects. So,
yeah,
he knows better than I do. All of his optimism is caveated with if I don't get further injuries.
Yeah.
And
he's clear, isn't he, that if I can avoid further injuries, I think the tennis is there.
Yeah. And it's very clear he takes loads from that win over Zverev at the Western and Southern Open. We had an interview with him on Prime that was done just before the ATP finals where he referenced that a lot. And in fact, he was asked about that win over Zverev, and then the 5-set win over Nishioka at the US Open, and then the very disappointing loss to Felix Auger-Aliassime. And he said, he actually talked about Sofia Kenin in the answer. He said, tennis is such a funny thing. He said, Sofia Kenin lost 6-love, 6-love to Victoria Azarenka, and then reached the French Open final 2 weeks later. He said, you know, that everyone has terrible days and bad results, and things can turn around very quickly, and matchups are everything. And yeah, I think that he's choosing to focus on the fact that he beat the US Open US Open finalist 2 weeks before he became the US Open finalist. And I also think he's not saying this in interviews, but I also really think that he thinks the standard required to be at the top of the game is going to come down. It perhaps already is slightly on the decline. And I think that gives him a bit of hope.
We'll see whether he has the necessary level in himself, I suppose, fitness permitting, to be able to get up there with it. Anyway, that's all for the future. He's going to go and drive himself into the ground, no doubt, over the next few weeks to try to get himself as fit as he possibly can. That much you know, don't you? There will be no stone left unturned. But it's been really fascinating to hear from John Millman today. We will be back with another tennis podcast on Monday, where we are doing a couple of things. One is we're looking ahead to launching our crowdfunding Kickstarter the following day. So we're going to look back on our year, both the tennis year and our enjoyment of it or experience of it. The highlights, the lowlights, and everything in between. But no, quite looking forward to doing that. So more tennis podcasts are coming your way. Catherine's going to go and look at the little video she's just been sent of Billie Jean, the dog.
Yeah. I think she's done her first little bark. Or certainly the first that's been captured on film.
Magnificent. Matt's going to go and edit this podcast. I'm going to go and make my kids dinner. And yeah, we will be back on Monday with another show. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.